Today we welcome novelist Andrew Hutchinson and chat about his new novel, One. He is also author of Rohypnol. Both novels focus on important social issues that encourage the reader to think from new perspectives. One is a compelling read about love, isolation, depression, and authenticity. If you enjoyed this episode, check out our back catalogue of incredible authors, including Longmire's Craig Johnson, Paige Toon, Jackie French, Kate Forsyth, James Fahey, Tim Harris, Wilka Starkus, Jack Heath, and many more. I'm your host, Danny V.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favourite authors.
Podcast, Andrew, and thank you so much for joining us to talk about your latest novel, One.
No problems. Thank you for having me.
I read this novel in one day, and I often feel a bit guilty saying that, and it must be quite conflicting for you, because obviously it means I couldn't put it down, but novel writing is often such a slow and painful process, and I know I'm not the only one who devoured your book in one day. How does it feel from a writer's perspective to go, you know, it may have taken you years to write, but I just, like, read this in an entire day?
I mean, that's what you're writing for. You obviously want your story to be compelling. So in that way, it's good. It's good that people get through it so quickly. Like, there's other reviews that have said that. They said that you get through it fast, but also, you know, it's hard to put down because the chapter structures, the way I've put it together, is that's how it's supposed to be. You're supposed to want to know what happens next. It's supposed to lead you into the next part and push you into trying to understand what's going on. So, yeah, that's the structure of the book. And the way I approach novel writing is probably slightly different. I don't know that it is, but it seems like it may be slightly different to some other writers in that I'm heavily influenced by film structure and moving things forward. So the way that I write tends to be a bit more proactive in that regard. It moves a bit quicker because in screenwriting, every scene has to be moving the story forward. You can't have any superfluous sort of developments. I sort of bring that across to when I'm writing, and I like it to move fast. So to me, it's a compliment. I think it's good that the story is compelling enough that you want to read through it quickly. But yeah, of course, it does take a long time to put all those bits and pieces together, and you hope that you haven't made it too fast so people don't absorb all the details and things you put in between. But yeah, I think it's a compliment. Yeah.
Yeah, no, it was one of those ones where you're right, I couldn't put it down. And it was, you know, that kind of idea of a film where the cliffhanger, and I just went, I just have to read one more chapter. And some of the chapters were quite small. And so you're like, just one more chapter or just three more chapters. It doesn't matter.
Yeah, I mean, that's the beauty of that structure of making it faster and quicker. You know, if you've got shorter chapters that move you on, then you see the next one, you're like, it's like two more pages. I'll just want to, you know, I'll just go through the next one. And that sort of propels you through the narrative. Ideally, as much as the story is compelling, it also the speed of it also propels you through the narrative. So,
yeah, absolutely. And one of your reviews compared it to Memento, and that's exactly what I was thinking as I was reading it, just that man looking for clues to make sense of his present. And that's one of my absolute favourite films. Were you inspired or influenced by anything that's out there or that you've seen?
Oh, like, there's lots of things. Like, everything you watch gives you some sort of inspiration. Yeah, the Memento comparison is definitely valid. Like, it wasn't something that was in the front of my mind, but yeah, as soon as they mentioned it, it's like, yeah, that does, that makes sense. That's sort of how the structure works. The book that it's most closely structured similar to is a book called The Coma by Alex Garland. Alex Garland wrote The Beach, and now he does films. His most recent film was Annihilation, which is on Netflix, but he also made Ex Machina. So yeah, his third novel was called The Coma, and yeah, it was about a man in a coma who doesn't realize he's in a coma. And then he slowly starts to work out that he's in a coma and tries to work out how he's going to get out of this situation. So similar to the sort of narrative structure of this book. I love the way that book was short and sweet, but also moved through it quickly and kept you held in the story. And you wanted to know what the next part was. It just propelled you along and kept giving you enough to keep you fed into the story and trying to work out, you know, trying to put the puzzle together as you're sort of reading it.
Yeah, and how does that impact your writing process when there is that kind of sense of urgency and immediacy and you're trying to reveal clues without revealing too much but still trying to keep the reader interested?
Yeah, it's a very difficult balance to get that right because you obviously want to give them enough information that the story is still makes sense, it still works, but not so much that they're going to be able to work out the whole thing straight away. Mm. I mean, you've got to look at it from a character's perspective. So the character's trying to work it out. So really you're just driving what he would be trying to work out, or he or she would be trying to work out, because you're looking at it from that narrative perspective. So I guess it's just taking that viewpoint and then trying to think what other things that would actually happen. Like, same with any story writing, you put yourself in the situation and go, if this was the reality of the world that you've created, what would actually happen? And I think, like, a book like Game of Thrones has done that really well, whereas most of those sort of fantasy books and prince and princesses and things like that, it's all beautiful and it's all, you know, the good guys win. Whereas if the world really was that way and it was all based on power and if you kill the king, you become the king, that sort of thing, then the people who win would actually be the ones who would do the most, who had no scruples, who would do anything to get there. So I think that sort of putting yourself in that position and thinking about what the world actually is what helps you sort of structure that way of moving forward, because that's what the character's trying to do. So ideally you can do that in a way that reveals it without giving too much away, but also starts to sort of tell the story, but also the deeper meaning of the story. And that's the harder part, is like, once you've got the propulsion of the story, it's like, that's one thing, you can move the story forward by giving you a compelling narrative, but what's the actual message you're trying to tell, and are you actually communicating that as you're writing? So that's where it gets a little bit more difficult, in that you want people to not only read it, but also absorb what the broader messaging is, and try to sort of, ideally at the end of it, try to sort of put that thinking on their own viewpoint and try and think about how they are in their own everyday life and how that message relates to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I really enjoyed sort of unraveling the puzzle with him. I felt that sort of really kept me going, because he didn't know more than I did. You know, we knew the same at the same amount of time, and I thought that was really interesting. And you say the novel explores a number of messages and important issues, which it does, but at its core, it's really a story about love, isn't it? And how we react and respond to love, and how it can destroy us if we let it.
Yeah, that was the main impetus that got me writing it. So in all the books that I've written, or all the stories I've written, there's some question that starts it. There's some reason why, like, I've found something where I'm like, I want to understand this more. I want to understand how this works, or try to think of a way that it could work. And so with this story, it was people in relationships and the crazy things people do, and the people will lose their houses and their money and their lives and all of these things for the approval, the acknowledgement of just that one person. Like, there's billions of people in the world. Why do we do that to ourselves? We need that one person to give us that acknowledgement. And that sort of is really fascinating, like, that we'll go to such extremes. So that's what I really wanted to explore. And in doing that, I wanted to create a narrative that put it in perspective, I guess, and put it in the character's perspective. Like, if you could see the things you do, maybe you would realize, you know, they're crazy, or maybe you don't realize the person you're becoming because of that obsession. So I guess that was the idea. And then it's the life flashes before your eyes type thing, where it's like, if life was to flash before your eyes, what would you really see? And would it show you all the good things you did, or would it show you all the bad things you did, or would it show you, you know, what would, if it was trying to give you, if you were trying to get an understanding of human life and your life, then what would you actually see? And so that was sort of another part where I was like, what makes us us, and what makes us make these decisions? And if you could see all those things that you've done, what would be your perspective then? Like, how would you view yourself? And I think that, like, if you're looking for a meaning of life type thing, it's like, well, if you could view your life, you would have a much better perspective on what the meaning of life actually is. Because as you're living it, you can't know that. You're living day to day, and you're just developing things as you go along. So I think there's someone, a philosopher had said that once, like, the only way that you can understand the meaning of life is to view it once you're no longer living, right? You can only see that's what that sort of was. So those are the sort of wider philosophical type things that drove the main story.
Yeah, and stepping outside of himself, because he often says, you know, it feels like that I'm watching it from a film perspective, you know, it doesn't feel real. And, you know, something I really loved about the book was the idea of empathy, and your protagonist is kind of representative of all of us. We go through life focusing on our own needs and our own perspectives rather than the people that we love or the people we hurt. And suddenly he says he's confronted with his own actions. You know, he says he realized his impact on the world and felt what she felt. And I thought this was really significant aspect of the novel, and something that, you know, we might explore as well in our own lives.
Yeah, and that's sort of, with all the Me Too movement and things like that, it's become a much bigger thing now, is that people don't necessarily realize the consequences of their actions. So there's the extreme cases, like when you see these cases of, like, the Harvey Weinstein and things like that, those are the extreme cases where it's like, very clearly this person knew that was predatory behavior. But there'd be a lot of other instances where people just don't realize they're overstepping the mark and they're doing things that are hurting people without necessarily knowing that's what they're doing. They see themselves as being committed, or I'm showing my commitment by sticking around and waiting for you, when really you're just putting more turmoil onto that person potentially, because that person's trying to move on and you're calling them every other week and saying, you know, how are you going? You might think I'm just being nice and just trying to make sure I stay connected and ideally we could get back together. Whereas that person might be like, well, I just want to move on with my life and this is an anchor that is just sort of making it hard for me. So I'm, from those minor examples onwards, there's lots of ways that we cause pain without necessarily realizing it. If you could see that from their perspective, you might be like, well, yeah, I probably, you know, I didn't realize that's what I was doing to that person, and maybe I should, you know, rethink my ways. And again, that comes back to the philosophical thing of, you know, what's the meaning of life and what's the meaning of being human and what we do to each other. And if you can see how you act and see yourself from a wider, broader perspective and see human actions from a broader perspective, then yeah, you would have a much better understanding. Like, I think that's one of the greatest things that literature can do, is that like one of the promises of new technology, like virtual reality and live streaming even and things like that, is that you can see things from someone else's perspective. And that's like a really big draw card for that, is that you're able to view things through someone else's eyes. And the closer you can get to that, the closer you can get to understanding someone else's life. And the closer you get to understanding someone else's life, the closer we get to understanding society more generally. And we can make make a better world because we all have a better perspective. Like, we can understand the plight of refugees much better. If you were actually able to see it through their eyes, then maybe you wouldn't have to have all these debates, or, you know, sort of academic debates about what it means. You could actually understand what it means on a human level. And so I think literature is the best way for us to do that in the current way, because novels let you see things from another perspective. They let you see through someone else's eyes. Someone else has written that, some other character's perspective, and you're able to sort of share in a different world. And I think that's really important to trying to get an understanding of how we work and how we sort of connect with each other and how society connects with each other. Like, if you could understand how someone else sees things or the things that they're going through, then yeah, you're going to have a lot more empathy and you're going to have a lot more understanding as to what it means, because you're actually feeling it, you're actually seeing it yourself. So I guess that was another part of it, is trying to really underline that and trying to show consider things from a different perspective.
And you've just said that so beautifully, because we make justifications all the time for our own behaviours, and you can pretty much justify anything, you know, if you think about it hard enough, if you believe it hard enough, and it's only through that other lens and through other people's perspectives that you can come outside of that, which is what your protagonist did. So it's really interesting and beautifully put.
Thank you. Yeah. I mean, that's driven, like in my first novel was called Rehypno, and that was about a group of young guys who were drink spiking in Melbourne. And that came about because there was more incidents of drink spiking happening in Melbourne, and that made no sense to me. Like, how could that possibly happen? And then not only one person doing it, how could a group of people do it? And no one go, hang on a second, we can't do this. Like, how does that actually come about? So I guess, again, it's trying to understand, like, not in that case, it's not an empathetic type thing. You don't want to try and make that a sympathetic thing at all. But just trying to see things from another perspective and seeing how they develop. And in like the comparison there that when we were talking about it just then came up was in Rehypnol, the character accepts that he's a bad person. He's like, well, people treat me like this. They think I'm bad, so that's who I am. So you're right. You can sort of convince yourself to become anyone. Mm-hmm. You know, whatever comes up, you can sort of, that's who I am now, right? And you can sort of change who you are dependent on what the situation is at the time. And all those different factors come into play, like, a newspaper headline doesn't explain a story. A newspaper headline just gives you the outcome of the story. But whatever has happened to that person in their life is what's led them to do, to undertake that action, or to think that that's the right action to take. So I find that really fascinating, is that anytime you see a story, anytime you see someone do something, they've done that because of their upbringing and things that have happened in their life. So what's happened to them that has made them believe that this is an acceptable course of action to take?
And it's that point as well. And, you know, when you're an adult, and no matter what's happened to you in the past, there is a point where you have to kind of go, well, hang on a minute, you know, where's my moral compass at, and what do I believe in, and what's right?
Yeah.
That personal responsibility.
That's right. It's raising those questions. Like, yeah, what do you view as right? And yeah, we're all a product of our circumstance. We're all a product of our upbringing and, you know, where we are and what we've done and whether you choose to come out of, you know, your little filter bubble or whether you don't. And especially now in the age of social media, where you can choose that, you know, I only talk to these people and I only get news from these sources, and you can sort of close in your world. People can just reinforce their own viewpoints to the point where they're just like, they only see the things that, yeah, you know, reinforce their own beliefs, and they're not getting that more diverse perspective. So, like, to me, the perspective is one of the biggest things in all of life, like understanding different people's, how different people live, how different people work. Like, I was working in Malaysia once, and just a completely different atmosphere, a completely different sort of place, and how they sort of get along with each other, with people from vastly different religious backgrounds and vastly different ethnic backgrounds. And there was no sort of, like, there wasn't as much, or didn't feel like there's much tension or anything, because it was just like, this is how it is. Like, that's what their country is. It's all these people come from different places, and we all come together and we just do it. And you're only going to get that perspective by actually going to somewhere or reading something, or, you know, trying to see things from that perspective, and then you can start to go, well, yeah, you know, I see what's going on. Like, if you limit your viewpoint and just go, well, I believe this and this supports that viewpoint, then, yeah, you're never going to evolve, and we're never going to evolve as a society if that's, you know, how we look at things.
And that's the wonderful thing about literature, isn't it? It does expose you to those things. And I think in both your novels, that moral ambiguity and the idea of raising more questions is really important. And in one, I mean, the woman has this unusual kind of haunting job, and she says, you know, she works with terminally ill patients, and she says, you give them hope in their last days. It's not such a bad thing. But it then makes you think, well, what's important? You know, is it important to have authenticity, or is it important just to make people feel better? So I thought that was a really interesting question as well.
Yeah, and that's exactly right. So, well, if you're in that situation, what would you do? Like, there's people who've got, you know, no hope, and there's grey areas in everything. There's different scenarios where, like, you might be totally opposed to something and say that is completely wrong, but if you were to understand the perspective, you might be like, well, in that scenario, it's slightly different. You know, there's different ways of looking at things, and there's different justifications as to what your actions what dictate your actions. And it's important when writing, like in literature, it's important to make sure that when you're trying to represent those characters, that you ensure that what their experiences, the sum of their experiences is reflected in their actions. So you can't just have this character who's had all these things happen to them do something completely where it's like, that doesn't even make any sense. If that person was actually gone through these things, their perspective would be different. So it's important to make sure that you're true to what that character's perspective would be based on their experiences in order to represent the story in the best way you can.
In one of your blog posts, you discuss loneliness and the lack of real human connections. And I thought that was really interesting, because we are connected via social media, but that, you know, isn't a real human connection. I thought that blog post was so interesting because it probably serves to make us more alone, you know, and he was obsessed and depressed and disconnected from others, and that really impacted him. So I think that was also a really important message in our world of social media and Twitter and Facebook, and how many human connections are we actually having?
Yeah, and that's the wider question of social media more generally. Is it good or bad for society? Because it becomes a popularity contest where it's like, look, I've got 1,000 connections and you've only got 100, right? But there's, like, academic research has shown that the human brain can only realistically process, you know, 150 actual personal relationships. You can only maintain that number of relationships. Anything outside of that, they're not real relationships. They're just sort of subsidiary type things. You might have, you know, contacts and work contacts and whatever else, but you're only able to maintain at any time up to 150 to maintain actual engaging relationships with more than 150 people. But social media makes it so it's become a competition where, all, you know, there's thousands of people, and you want to try and connect with as many as you can. You want to try and promote your authority, but it's also completely selective. So they're only posting the best bits. You're not seeing all bad things. So yeah, it makes it a very difficult tool for comparison, because if you're like, well, my life's not going that good, and then you look at these people you went to school with and their life seems to be going so great, then it makes it worse. And you're like, yeah, now I feel really bad because all these people seem to have got their lives worked out. But if you had actually been able to see their day-to-day life, you'd realize they don't. No one does. Like, no one's got everything worked out. So that's the danger of social media, is that it gives you that false sense of what people's lives are really about, and that false comparison, which then, yeah, contributes to that compounded loneliness, I guess, where if you're more disconnected, if you're not among the social group that's always been, you know, active and going out and things like that, then, yeah, it can make it even more isolating, because you can see that other people are going out and you're not. So,
and it's terrifying, isn't it? Because we're the guinea pigs of this whole social media generation, aren't we? So we don't actually know how it's going to impact us until maybe it's too late.
Well, that's right. And that's what they're talking about at the moment, all this stuff about privacy and data and Facebook accessing your data and things like that. It's like, well, it's unprecedented. Like the stat that gets thrown around is what, there's 90% of the world's data was created in the last 2 years. So there's more data than, like, way more data than we've ever had access to. And no one knows what that means because it's never existed. So no one can understand exactly how they could create psychographic profiles which could influence your voting habits, because it's never been a problem before. We've never had to address it. So I've written another novel which I'm working on at the moment. In that, I sort of try to address more of that social media stuff, where when the one of the characters is feeling lonely, she does exactly that. She's looking up at the school with it and getting more and more like down on herself. And it's looking at that impact and what that actually means. Like, there's obviously benefits to social media. I think one of the biggest benefits is being able to connect to niche groups. Like, if you're really into some weird thing, if you're really into, I don't know, bonsai trees, and that's not as weird, but you know what I mean? If you're into a niche interest, you can find people online who are into that same thing, and you can connect with them, and that must be very sort of liberating for those people to actually be able to connect. And it gives more freedom to be able to find people who are into the same things you're into, rather than being restricted to your geographic groups. But at the same time, the highlight reel thing, I think in particular, is particularly dangerous, especially for younger generations who are a lot more influenced by that stuff, taking 100 pictures of themselves to get the right one they can post to Instagram, things like that, where it's like, that doesn't seem very healthy. But then again, it's possible that the selfie culture makes it more healthy, because you're taking selfies of yourself like all the time, you're getting much more comfortable with how you look, maybe. And so maybe that gives you a bit more self-confidence. I don't know. It's hard to, we don't know. Like, we don't know where that full impact will be.
It'd be very interesting in 50 years when they're talking about us now and going, oh, this was the impact.
Yeah, that's what I'm, and the next level of social media is we're going to all be connected in virtual reality anyway. So we're all going to be in VR headsets, and you can just put forward whatever representation of yourself you want. So it won't even really matter what you look like. So, I don't know.
It's a strange world. And, you know, you talked about mental health stats as well in one of your blogs, and, you know, 8 people die from suicide a week in Australia. And, you know, mental health is obviously such an important issue in our current society. And I do wonder, I mean, I'm sure none of us have the answer here, but the impact of, you know, these fake connections or this inauthenticity, or, you know, what social media is doing to us. So it's interesting that these were kind of, you know, touched on in your novel as well, about that authenticity and connection.
Yeah, I mean, the big thing that I was trying to sort of look at, and that is the loneliness. Like, the main character is obviously so lonely and so sort of destroyed by that relationship that it's sort of very difficult for him to reintegrate into society. And yeah, suicide's something that no one really wants to address. It's very difficult to address. Obviously, there's no real way to know. But so many high-profile cases and things like that, like we've got the Chris Cornell and Chester Bennington and things like that, where it's like, these people seem to have had it all. It makes no sense to us as outsiders. Like, why would they possibly want to do that? But I think it's really important that we look into those issues. And loneliness is one of the biggest causes. And just trying to think about those people who you haven't got in contact with and who might be struggling, and just making sure you reach out if you can.
Nature is such a prominent part of Australian literature, and it played a significant role in your novel as well, because it kind of becomes a metaphor for letting go, you know, for restoration or atonement. And I thought this focus on nature sort of juxtaposed the disconnections we feel as well, and maybe getting back into nature and less into those fake connections, you know, help restore us as human beings.
There's obviously quite a few references, like there's a lot of stuff in the ocean and things like that. I mean, they're essentially in the book, you know, you're looking at things that have happened, I guess. So it wasn't so much about nature as a tool to sort of communicate as much as it was, that's, you know, a part of the surroundings that they're in. But looking at the sort of shape of trees and things like that, that's definitely something that I think that's important to try and connect you to the world, I guess, connect you to the real world, as opposed to sort of getting tied up in all these other distractions, all these other things that are happening that are not necessarily, you know, sort of as beneficial. So I guess in that sense, it's using it as a grounding effect to make sure that you're, you know, pulling it back to what reality is, and, you know, using different sort of the shapes and things of the world and the leaves and whatever to sort of represent some of those parts that connect us back to who we are, I guess.
Yeah, being present and not being attached to the screen in your hand.
Yeah.
I saw on Twitter as well, you writing by hand, and I love this. I've spoken to a couple of authors who do that. Do you actually do that for your novels?
I've tried different approaches at different times. Like, obviously, it's all experimentation and trying to sort of see what works and whatever. So generally, I do. Yeah, generally, I write everything by hand. I'm working on two different novels at the moment, and one of them I've completely written by hand. It's like, 50,000 words, up to 50,000 words by hand so far. And another one I completely wrote on the computer. So I don't know that there's a definitive, like, this is the way it must be.
Mm-hmm.
But I like the idea of being able to write by hand, because it's obviously, it's connected straight to your head. The sort of, like, obviously people can touch type and things like that, so it's very similar, but I like the sort of natural flow of it. Like, I'm able to just sort of let it sort of run over the page, let the pen run over the page, and as my thoughts sort of rush through, I guess I could probably type as fast now as as where I'm thinking, but I've always found that it was easier to sort of, it's more connected, it's more of a flow to writing by hand, and it also gives you a second draft process, because obviously once you've written by hand, then you've got to transcribe it back across to a computer. Some people would say, well, why don't you just do it on a computer in the first place, you idiot, and that's fine, that makes sense, but I do like the flow, and I do like being able to just take my pad, especially if I'm going out somewhere, if I'm going out to a cafe or something to write. I don't know that I'd necessarily like taking my laptop all the time. I like to just take my pad and pen and just sit there and write. So, I don't know, there's something that feels authentic about it to a degree, and it's going to die out, I guess, handwriting. Like, I don't know, the kids are going to bother. Like, it's almost irrelevant to them now, like when they're learning on the laptops and iPads and things like that. It's like, do they really need to learn handwriting? Like, they probably get by their entire life without doing it at all. But I really like handwriting. It's something that sort of feels connected to it, and I like sort of being able to sort of flow through my sentences and think of them a bit more structure than, I guess it feels a bit more rigid when it's on a screen. Mm. It feels a bit more set even, whereas on a page it just feels a bit more flowing.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. And when I saw it on Twitter, I was quite excited about it because I love that. And I'm actually a teacher, an English teacher, and I always encourage kids to write with their hands in a pen because I think that's a really organic experience, you know?
I can imagine a lot of them just look at you confused saying, what are you talking about? Why would a pen? You do that?
Aren't we going to type it anyway? Like, what's the point?
Also, but there's so many things like where it's like, well, kids wouldn't even understand what a window wander is in the car or whatever. It's just changing. And it makes sense. Like, we've moved on, right? Things are a lot different to what they used to be. But, I would love to believe that handwriting would live on. But I also see that there's not going to be a lot of use for it.
Yeah, well, they've got the pens for the iPads now. So I guess that's kind of something, right?
Yeah, well, you can also draw in virtual reality. You can wear those masks, but those new things where you can put words on the screen and whatever. But, you think more and more. Well, I think it'll all be just communicated in emojis. We're just going back to hieroglyphics of the Egyptian days rather than anything else. There'll be novels entirely in emojis.
Yeah, look, I think that's coming. We joke, but I think that's coming.
I have no doubt someone's already tried it at least, and I imagine it's probably in progress to some degree. It would be indecipherable, surely. As a novelty, you'd imagine someone's obviously going to give it a shot.
I always ask authors about their writing process, and I like that you state in one of your blog posts that it can't be a prescriptive process. And when writing, it's about examining, not getting definitive answers. And I also liked when you say that you hope that your work contributes to opening new tracks of thought, which I think we've established that it has from this interview. Can you tell us more about your process? Do you let the characters drive your story? Are you a plotter, or are you somewhere in between?
The first thing is what's driving. As I say, with the written novel, it was like, all right, well, how is this happening and why would this be happening? And then it was thinking of a story that could lead to someone being involved in that, like in a way that not that you could understand, not that you could justify it, but understand it, I guess. It was trying to sort of think what are the things that could happen. So that's where I always start, is what's the question? And with one, it was, why do we do these crazy things when we're in love, and what sort of what drives us to be completely driven by the opinion of one other person? Once you start from there, then it just sort of starts to sort of churn over in my head for a while, and you've got to get to a point. Like, one of the hardest parts of the novel, especially with people who are just starting out, is that it's got to be long enough as well, right? It's got to be an idea that's going to go for a length that will qualify as a novel. If you get to the 15,000 words and you're pretty much done, you're in trouble. So you don't want to get to that point. You don't want to get to 15,000 words and then realize you've wasted your time. So you've also got to think about what the structure is. So definitely I do plot it to a degree, but my plotting is very basic. So all I do is I've got one page and I'd be like, the way I initially approached novel writing, I did short stories initially, like a lot of short fiction stuff, and I didn't know that I could write a novel. And my initial approach was, if I can put together 30 or 40 short stories that construct a novel, that would be easy, right? Because I can write short stories, no problem. I can knock out 1,000 words pretty quickly. So that's sort of the same way I approach it even now, is that I think about, all right, well, what would the short stories be that would contribute to the whole, and what would the next chapter be in a sort of self-enclosed way to a degree? Like, it's obviously going to be a part of the wider narrative, but I just write down, jot down the bit by bit, right? Here's the first chapter, here's what happens in this one, here's what happens in this one. I've got a whiteboard that I've got all the chapters on, and then I start to look at it and go, right, well, it feels like there might be a bit of a gap in that part, it feels like maybe might have a gap in that part. But really, like, in a first draft sense, that's what I'll do. I'll write down all the sort of essential elements. I'll put them all down on one of my notepads. I take two notepads with me. I have one of them open with the chapters that are coming up, or the parts that I want to include in each part. So I'll sort of say, they're driving here, and then it'll have little dot points on each. These things have to happen in this chapter, and then sort of go through it all. And then once I've got to the end of the first draft, that's when I really start to sort of break down a bit further and put it all out onto the, as I say, the whiteboard. So you've got, here's the three-act structure to a degree. Here's where the first, second, third act are. Here's all the sections within it. And then you start to look for the gaps and start to figure out where you can sort of really reinforce the narrative, reinforce the themes of the book, but also make sure that you're filling in all the areas where it doesn't feel like it's fleshed out enough yet. So it's just trying to make sure that you put in all the gaps and cover all the bases and, yeah, really capitalize on the payoffs in the end. Like, if you've got something that's going to come up, then where can you put it earlier that's going to make sure that really reinforces the importance of that message? So I wouldn't say that I'm a really strict plotter. I don't have to have any really definitive, it has to be regimented. This has to happen here. And also not one of those people who has to write a certain amount of words per day.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a basic sort of structure where it'll be like, all right, well, I would like to get through this much of this book. I like to check through it. Like, if I'm rereading or re-editing, then I like to go through and make sure that I'm getting at least one chapter done per day.
Yeah.
But in the story, if I'm writing a story, it's just like I just want to get through, feel like I've got through a good chunk of it, or a good piece of it for that day. If I feel like I've sort of got through the 2 points, I'm just like, yeah, that was a good writing that day, and I can sort of, you know, move on.
That's a really interesting way to approach it, through the idea of short stories too. I like that idea. It probably propels you forward a bit more and makes it not so intimidating to get to all those words.
Yeah, I stole it off someone else. I can't even remember who it was, but I read it in another writer was talking about it once. Because, as I say, at the time, I was just writing short fiction. And I was like, I don't know that I could write 50,000 words or 60,000 words or 80,000 words. I can write 1,500, no problems. I can write these short little things. I was really into short stories, entering in competitions all the time. But, the novel sort of intimidated me. But after it sort of won a few short story competitions and done reasonably well, been published in quite a few journals and things like that, it was sort of like, if you really want to be a writer, if you really want to get anywhere as a career, or, you know, make anything as a writer, then you're going to have to do longer fiction. So, that was the approach that someone had said, that they sort of looked at it as, well, if you can write this many short stories within that structure, then, yeah, that'll work. So that's true. That makes perfect sense to me. So that was takes a bit of the intimidation factor out of it. If you're not thinking of the whole thing, you're just thinking about that one part and just making sure that one part really resonates, then that sort of, it feels less burdensome, I guess, or less sort of intimidating, sort of not hanging over your head that you have to reach a certain word count or anything. You're more focused on that one point and just getting that one right, and then you move to the next one. And sort of, yeah, hopefully in the end it all comes together and you're like, yeah, that works. And you won't know, like, when you're writing a novel, you don't know that it's going to work until you're at least 30,000 words in. And then you sort of start to go, yeah, I think this is probably right. And that's really scary, right? Because that's a lot of work to get to that point.
Yeah.
I would say that no author knows for sure that it's fully going to come together till about that point. There's some that are sort of a bit more, some forms of writing that are a bit more formulaic and a bit easier, I guess, to plan in that way. But, I would imagine that most authors struggle with that, like not knowing for sure that this is really going to come off the way it is in your head until you get to, at least 30,000 words or so. But the more I've written long-form fiction, the more I've been able to understand that better as well. So, yeah.
And what was your publishing journey like? I mean, there's been a few years between the two books that you have had published. And I always hear it's, you know, a lot of hard work, a bit of luck, a bit of everything else in between. What were your publishing journeys like?
Yes, it is. Like, my first book, I wrote that as an experiment, as we just said, like, it was more just like, well, I've written lots of short fiction, could I write long fiction? And it was more to see whether I could actually do it more than anything else. It wasn't to be, I wasn't like, I'm going to do this to be published. I was like, I'm going to do this to see if I can do it.
Mm-hmm.
Which was really good because it took every sort of level of, all the extra concerns in that were sort of drained away because I wasn't worried about what people were going to think of it. I was worried about just trying to get it done as an experiment. So, that made it a lot easier in retrospect now. It's a lot less intimidating. But if my friends read it, that'd be great, and I'll be happy with that. If no one read it, whatever, it doesn't matter. It was just an experiment to see if I could do it. And if I could do this one, I'll write one that's better the next time.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, that's all I was trying to do. I put it all together. And then once I sort of got to the point where I'm like, I can't think of anything else I could do with this, I feel like it's pretty good. And the feedback I got from my friends was pretty good. I'm going to send it to a couple of competitions. And one of the competitions was a mentorship competition with Express Media in Melbourne, and the mentorship was with Christos Shokas, and I won that. So that was obviously a big boost because having someone of his stature sort of acknowledge that my book was good enough was in itself was enough. Like, even if we'd never spoken again, to be like, well, the fact that he even considered my book up to that level was far more of a compliment than anyone could ever give me. But I worked with Christos for, we probably worked together for about 6 or 9 months or so. Like every few weeks, we'd meet up either at his place or a cafe or something like that, and we'd go over parts. So what he would sort of say is like, he went through the novel and he said, all right, these are the parts that I think you probably need to work on. What are the parts you need to work on? And so I sort of identified 6 or so chapters. He identified 6 or so chapters, and then we went over them. And he gave me fit in what he thought and sort of just refine them a bit more and make sure we put it all together. So at the end of that process, again, it was like, well, now I'm really happy with it. I think it really works. And Chris was like, yeah, it's a good novel. It works really well. He sent it to his publisher at Random House and said, look, I can't promise this is going to go anywhere, but try it out. But because there's no promises there and because you don't know what's going to happen, I also sent it to the Victorian Premier's Literary Awards in Melbourne. And I won the Best Unpublished Manuscripts in 2006, so that's obviously a big boost as well. Yeah. It gives you, like, there's the prize money, but also the recognition. But Random House did offer me a contract, so the way I got in was not through the sort of traditional means, so definitely a level of luck involved. Mm-hmm. But for me, it was more about putting my work out there, and I think that's one thing that does hold a lot of people back is they're hesitant to actually put their stuff in, especially the novels, because they've worked on them for so long and you put so much of your heart into it, it would just destroy you if someone was to say, this is just not good enough, right? Like, it's very intimidating, very scary to put your work out there, especially when you put so much of your heart into it to, you don't know what people are going to say. For me, as I say, I was pretty solid because it was like, well, I don't really care. If it's no good, then it's no good. Like, it was more of an experiment. So I've always been pretty proactive in that regard, it's sending stuff out, but definitely a level of luck, but also being willing to sort of put your work out there. So that was my initial path, and then from there, Random House signed me up to another contract. That was one was supposed to come out in 2009. Mm-hmm. And I was having lots of trouble writing it because completely different to the first one. This time it was like, all right, well, now there's expectation. That expectation wasn't coming from people at Random House. It wasn't coming from, I'm not J.K. Rowling, I don't have 500,000 people waiting for my next book. It was all internally, in my own head, I was like, this has to be great. This has to be great literature. Like, it can't just be you sort of mucking around and trying to put something together. This is going direct to publishers. This is going direct to an audience. And everything I wrote, I would reread and go, what? This is not good enough, right? This is not what a published author would write. So there was a big sort of, it's the imposter syndrome where it's like, I don't know that I'm good enough for this. I don't know that I've had the capacity of this. And you're questioning, I'm looking at it going, I don't know that I can do this. But I already had done it. I'd already written a book. So why couldn't I do it? Like, why couldn't I, put something together? So that was, I had a long sort of mental battle of trying to make sure that, trying to get out of my own head and stop talking myself out of it. And the breakthrough on that front was that for a long time, I tried to make it more elaborate than it needed to be because I felt like it needed to be this grand work of literary significance. Mm-hmm. I wanted to sort of build it and build it and build it and make it something bigger than it was. And I realized I didn't have to do that. Like, what the central story I wanted to tell was this. So get back to that. And eventually I did that. And it took years, obviously, having kids and getting married and moving to state and things like that in between. But, yeah, the biggest thing was just breaking it down and going, what's the actual message you're trying to communicate? What's the actual story here? All these other things that you've added into it are not adding to that. They're just, you know, they're sort of more, just these elaborate sort of decorations that you're putting around it because you're trying to make it, you know, sound more than it is. But you can do it. Like, you can write this. This is the story you want to write. And so that's what I had to sort of get back to. And once I finally had that breakthrough, and then I structured the whole thing and figured it all out, and I was like, yep, this feels exactly what I want to communicate. And that's eventually, yeah, the novel is exactly what I felt like I wanted to communicate in the story.
Thank you for being so honest. It's really interesting hearing that from writers. And it is, when you say you put so much of your heart in it, and so many people have, you know, that self-doubt that kind of hinders them. So it's a good story, especially because the novel ended up being such a wonderful story. Now, you've written your third novel. Where is this in the publishing process?
Well...
Or is it still in the handwriting stages?
No, I've written two. So
okay.
One had happened. Once I got into a flow of writing, I got into a sort of good... it took me a long time to get back into that creative flow. There was a long time where I wasn't sort of writing anything. But once I got to the... Once I was writing one again and got back to a flow, I'd sort of structured a workday around that where I had a couple of hours before I picked the kids up, where I've got a couple of hours to myself that I can work on writing. So once I was into that, I was like, well, I don't want to lose that. So once one was in its editing stage, and there's sort of long periods in that editing stage where you've got months of you're not hearing anything, there's not anything you can do. It was like, well, I've got this time to do writing. I want to work on the next thing. And so I went through my notes and found another idea that I had. I sort of put it all together, reworked it, and thought, yeah, this is actually pretty solid. And then, got that down reasonably quickly. It only took about a month or so to write a full first draft of that one. Which is like when I say it to people, it's like it took 11 years to write the other one, and it takes four weeks to write another one. But again, it's just that sort of freeing your mind, I guess, just breaking out of your own mental sort of barriers and just going, yeah, you can do it. Like, it's once you sort of realize you have that capacity in you, then it's much easier to sort of get back into it. So once I got to the end of that one, I started writing another one because, again, I had that time. And I'm editing, but I sort of felt like I wanted to give it a bit of space before I really started editing it. I wanted to sort of leave it alone for a while because then you're a bit more objective. You can sort of look at it a bit more with a bit more objective eyes. So in that space, I was like, well, maybe I should try and write something else so that I can sort of distract myself from one of the ideas. I can work on the two and I can keep that momentum moving without losing anything by just sort of going, yeah, you know, I don't have to do any work today. If I've got another story to work on, then it's like, well, I can just work on that instead. Or if I'm not feeling it on one of the stories, I can just go, well, I can work on the other one and make sure that I'm getting that right. So I just finished the first draft of another one yesterday, actually. And that's, obviously very, very early. I've just finished that. And it was more just a thing where I was just writing as much as I could and seeing where it went. I do have two other ones that hopefully will come out. I'm not sure, like maybe Random House will be like, well, it took you 11 years last time. I think they'll wait till I've definitely got a fleet first draft before they give me any deadlines or anything to get through. But my publisher's always been very supportive, and I've every hope that both stories are going to end up being good enough. Hopefully you improve every time, and the next story will hopefully go on from there and continue on. I guess it's getting into that frame of like, all right, this is what I do. And there's also an element of like with the first one, it's like, well, this is going to change my life right now. I'm going to be a writer full time. When once you sort of do that, you realize that you're not going to be a writer full time. Like, most people are not going to make enough money to be a writer full time. So there's a big shift, I guess, in what your perception of being a writer is. And once you're actually doing it, you've got a lot more perspective. And it took me a long time to sort of rationalize all those different elements. And now that I have, I feel reasonably confident that I'm on a good sort of path to making sure I'm creating good stuff. But again, only one person has read my third novel, and he said it was very good. He said it was the best I've written. So hopefully that's a good sign. So we'll see how we go.
Well, I look forward to them both.
Yeah, cool.
Thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. The novel one was brilliantly thought-provoking novel that, you know, because of its immediacy and need to solve the puzzle that absolutely had to be read very quickly in my mind. So it was a real pleasure chatting with you. So thank you so much for joining us.
Again, thank you for having me.
You are listening to Words and Nerds, talking to your favorite authors.